Right, here we go. This is Didactic Mind, episode 23, Myth Busting. Very warm welcome, as always, to all of my loyal readers from the blog. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud listeners and followers. Today, I want to talk about some of the myths and legends that we have been taught throughout our lives, which is important and appropriate at this particular point in time. I mean, I've referenced this before about the great lies of our time in a previous podcast, and I want to take a look very squarely at one particular myth about the Great Depression, because it's an important topic to address right now, given that with the ongoing spread of the Kung Flu, with the Chinese pandemic raging as it is throughout the world, the fact is the world is headed toward a massive economic depression right now. And the question is not whether it will happen. It's not if the world is going to go into a depression. The question is, how long will it last and how bad will it be? That's it. The answer to those questions, or those two questions, depends entirely upon what course governments and government institutions take to address the issues. Now, the only points of reference that we have within the last 100 years or so for similar events come from the Great Depression and from exactly 100 years ago, the Depression of 1920 to 21. I talked about the latter in last week's podcast, where I talked about how, despite a complete or near complete absence of any government intervention of any kind, the United States economy recovered from a colossal drop in output and production and an extremely sharp spike in unemployment within about 6 months. And within 1 year, the economy was roaring ahead to the point where the resulting decade was called the Roaring Twenties. It was perhaps the greatest period of wealth creation and generation of the 20th century. There's some debate about that, but it was unquestionably a phenomenal decade of growth. And the next depression after that, the depression of the 1930s, truly was a great depression. But it was created by government policy, and it was created by the fact that the government constantly and consistently intervened and stopped the market from figuring out what needed to be done. Now, there are a number of myths that have to be destroyed in order for people to understand that governments don't possess the answer. And unfortunately, for the last 100 or so years, we have been taught incorrectly that government saved the day during the Great Depression. Government did not save the day. Government was the problem. Government was the reason why that depression lasted as long as it did. Now, there is room, considerable room, for debate about what is the appropriate role of government during an economic crisis. Where should a government intervene and where should it hang back? Where should a government try to correct market failures, and where should a government try to avoid getting in the way? This is not mere dry academic debate. This is not something that mere academicians will sit around in coffee shops and discuss using technical details and mathematics. This is real. It affects people's daily lives. And when academics get things wrong, which they do quite frequently, the rest of us end up paying a terrible price for it, as the world did during the Great Depression. The prevailing wisdom at the time was that basically governments, that markets would self-clear. They would immediately figure out what was going on, and they would eventually come to the appropriate match between supply and demand, and the result would be full employment very quickly. Now, the problem, this is well, it was. It is not that this was wrong. It is not true that this was incorrect. It is true that the facts on the ground did not seem to match the theory. Why didn't that happen? Well, if you read, let's say, Amity Schlesz's book, which I referenced last week, The Forgotten Man, or if you read The Failure of the New Economics by Henry Hazlitt, you will quickly realize that what people were told about the Great Depression was a series of lies. The history that we've been taught since then, particularly in school, not in university, but in school, tells us that Herbert Hoover was a laissez-faire president who didn't do a damn thing, didn't lift a finger to stop the Depression from unfolding. But that is simply not true. Herbert Hoover was one of the most interventionist presidents that the country has ever seen. The reality is that Herbert Hoover's interventions actually made the Depression much worse. The market was on the way to healing itself by mid-1930. Unemployment had started to climb down, output had started to resume, things were getting back to relatively normal. Bad debts were getting cleared out, inventories had been liquidated, industries had been realigned. This is what you would normally expect to see in the course of a massive economic correction, which is what the crash of 1929 was. It was a massive and badly needed economic correction. So to understand where this myth comes from, that government action solved the Great Depression, you first have to examine the roots of the Great Depression. The roots of the Great Depression are very easily traced. They come down to the institution in the 1920s, in the mid-1920s specifically, of open market operations by the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve as an institution started out in 1913. It was created by an act of Congress, the Federal Reserve Act. However, one of the great myths surrounding the Federal Reserve is that it is an independent government agency. It is absolutely nothing of the sort. The Federal Reserve is not an independent government agency at all. It is not subject to the oversight of the U.S. government. It is not subjected to oversight from Congress. And in fact, if you know anything about the Fed, the Federal Reserve has fought tooth and nail for the last 100 years to avoid any kind of scrutiny from Congress. Every time Congress has tried to audit the Federal Reserve and to figure out what exactly is on its balance sheet, the Federal Reserve has fought back with everything at its disposal, every tool available to it, to stop Congress from showing the American people exactly what's going on. Okay. The Federal Reserve, as I said, is not a creation of government. To be more accurate, the Federal Reserve is not an instrument of government. The Federal Reserve is, in fact, created, or is, in fact, a tool of private banks. It is, in fact, the bank of last resort for the banks. So it is created and maintained by the banks themselves. The banks of the United States use the Federal Reserve as their banker. Now, to understand why this is so devastating to an economy, you have to understand that the Federal Reserve effectively operates as though, just like J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America or Wells Fargo, or, to take an even more horrifying example, Deutsche Bank in Germany or HSBC in London. It's like any other bank, except it is not beholden to shareholders. The shareholders are the banks. The people who kind of have controlling stakes in the Federal Reserve are main American banks. So there is no oversight of the Fed. There is no way that you can punish the Fed for making bad investment decisions by tanking its stock price. There is no way that you can get a run on the Federal Reserve to remove your deposits from the Fed, because there is no set of individual depositors that deposit with the Fed. The way it works is you put in your savings, you put in your deposits, your checking accounts at Chase Manhattan, or, you know, JPMorgan Chase as it is now, Bank of America. Wells Fargo, SunTrust Bank, you know, Charles Schwab Bank, even. And they will then go and put their deposits into the Federal Reserve. They will deposit with the Fed, and they will get overnight lending rates from the Federal Reserve. They will get long-term lending rates from the Fed. So the level of accountability is completely removed. Now, why is this important for the 1920s? Well, when the Federal Reserve began open market operations, that resulted in debt being created out of nothing. And this is the second myth we need to talk about. There is a myth out there in economic literature that says that basically the monetary system of a fiat currency operates by essentially creating money out of nothing. Now, that's partly true. That is actually partly true. But it's not the whole truth. The myth involved here has to do with the idea that there is something behind the manipulation of interest rates, that something tangible, something worthwhile, something that is not debt, is behind all of this money that's being created. To understand open market operations, we need to turn to an article from Investopedia, and this will explain it much more clearly than I can. So, I'll include a link to it, and I'm going to read out portions of this article. What are open market operations? The Federal Reserve purchases and sells U.S. Treasury securities on the open market in order to regulate the supply of money that is on deposit in U.S. banks, and therefore available to loan out to businesses and consumers. It purchases Treasury securities to increase the supply of money and sells them to reduce the supply of money. By using this system of open market purchasing, the Federal Reserve can produce the target federal funds rate it has set. It calls this process its open market operations. Understanding open market operations. The federal funds rate is the interest percentage that banks charge each other for overnight loans. This constant flow of vast sums of money allows banks to keep their cash reserves high enough to meet the demands of customers while putting excess cash to use. The federal funds rate is also a benchmark for other rates. Right now, the federal funds rate is in fact used as a benchmark for global LIBOR rates and is used for constructing curves. I know this firsthand because I was heavily involved in curve construction projects, in differential discounting projects in two different banks, and in particular Deutsche Bank. When I was working there, there was considerable debate about how to build yield curves correctly. This is much more important than it sounds. It sounds like a trivial issue. It's not. The way you discount derivatives is fundamental to their value and their price. If you discount using just plain old LIBOR, which is what was done back in the days before 2008, then that ignores fundamentally the quality of the collateral behind the derivative. And if you discount using something different, like overnight index swap, OIS, or federal funds rate, then that takes into account the quality of the collateral behind the derivative. And because the Fed funds rate is significantly below the LIBOR rate, the LIBOR rate being the rate at which banks will lend to one another, double A plus rated banks, double A rated and above, will lend to one another, and it's set in London. It's benchmarked at 11 a.m. on every weekday. The difference between those two fundamentally changes the value of your derivative product. So it is very important to get both the LIBOR rate and the Fed funds rate right. And once you understand that by changing the federal funds rate, just how big an impact the Federal Reserve has upon the global economy, now you understand how much power the Fed has, because the global market for interest rate derivatives is orders of magnitude greater in terms of monetary value than the value of the global economy. The global economy is what, worth, $60 trillion, something like that, of which the United States accounts for nearly a third of that share in nominal terms. When you realize that the global market for fixed income derivatives alone is like $300 trillion, then you're going to realize very quickly that by affecting the rate at which those derivatives are discounted and priced, The Federal Reserve has power over every single sector of the entire global economy. And this is not an accident. This resulted from steps taken 100 years ago to develop all the power that they have now. Anyway, continuing on, the federal funds rate is also a benchmark for other rates, influencing the direction of everything from savings deposit rates to home mortgage rates and credit card rates. The Federal Reserve sets a target federal funds rate in an effort to the to keep the U.S. They're missing a word there, to keep the U.S. economy on an even keel and to forestall the ill effects of uncontrolled price inflation or deflation. Interjecting again, that's pure bullshit. Inflation and deflation are always and everywhere monetary phenomena. Okay. Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. Deflation is too little money chasing too much goods. Okay. They are related, but the causes are usually fundamentally different. Debt deflation is what we're looking at in the future. I don't believe we're looking at an inflationary scenario. I believe we're looking at debt deflation. And I'll explain why. Coming back to this, its open market operations are the tools it uses to reach that target rate. Why treasuries? Well, U.S. treasuries are government bonds that are traded by many individual consumers as a safe investment. They are also traded on the money markets and are purchased and held in large quantities by financial institutions and brokerages. Open market operations allow the Federal Reserve to buy or sell treasuries in such large quantities that it has an impact on the money supply distributed in banks and other financial institutions around the U.S. Okay, so how does it do this? By buying treasuries, if the Fed's goal is to expand the money supply, it buys treasuries in order to push cash, pour cash into the banks. That puts pressure on the banks to lend that money out to consumers and businesses. As the banks compete for customers, interest rates drift downwards. Consumers are able to borrow more to buy more. Businesses are eager to borrow more and to expand. If the Fed's goal is contractionary, it sells treasuries in order to pull money out of the system. Money gets tight, interest rates drift upward. Consumers pull back on their spending, businesses trim their plans for growth, and the economy slows down. Now, there's a lot of oversimplification going on there. A lot of this is, frankly, nonsense. But the key parts about buying and selling treasuries, or in the more modern approach, buying and entering into long or short, basically buying or selling in repurchase agreements, repo agreements on the open repo market. That part is correct. So let's say the Federal Reserve wants to expand the money supply and they buy treasuries. What does that do? When you buy treasuries, the price of treasuries goes up, the yield on the treasuries goes down, and that by buying treasuries, that basically puts money back. You know, the way it works is not the treasuries are not bought directly from the government. Okay, this is the key part to understand. Open market operations do not happen where the central bank buys treasuries directly from the government. There are two markets for treasuries. There's the primary market and the secondary market. The way that treasuries are bought initially in the primary market is through an auction. There is every month or every couple of weeks, 3 weeks, I think. The U.S. Treasury holds an auction for its debt where everybody, you know, all the various banks and all the various financial institutions from around the world, and governments as well, by the way, can come to the Fed and GICs, government investment corporations, so basically sovereign wealth funds. They can all come to the U.S. government and bid on U.S. Treasury debt if they see a particularly attractive bond that's selling at a good yield for 30 years, let's say, and the U.S. Treasury offers these bonds out to the public. The Treasury Department will set a particular yield level on that bond. They will offer a yield of, let's say, 2.5% for 30 years. And you know, that will pay every 6 months. Like you'll get a coupon every 6 months, an interest payment every 6 months. So the bond pays semi-annually for 30 years at 2.5%. Then all these various bidders come in and they say, you know, I want to buy this much, I want to buy that much, at such and such price. I will buy this lot of these bonds at such and such price. And the Treasury Department will, of course, sell to the highest bidder, and that is the price at which that bond will trade in the market now. Okay? Now, once those bonds are sold to banks, they are held on balance sheets of those banks. All right? Banks everywhere have entire trading desks devoted specifically to buying and selling treasuries. Those treasuries are then bought and sold on the open secondary market. The primary market is mostly closed, not entirely, but mostly. The secondary market is open. Anybody can buy and sell U.S. treasuries as long as you have an investment account and sufficient capital to do so. So it's not cheap, but you can do it. I mean, if you wanted to buy bonds right now, you could do it. You could do it either yourself by being registered with the U.S. Treasury Department, which I don't recommend, or you could do it indirectly through your 401k plan, through ETFs, through mutual funds, and even more indirectly by buying shares in companies that have large treasury investments, you know. So there are lots and lots and lots of ways to invest in U.S. Treasury bonds. The way that the Federal Reserve System works is it will buy and sell those bonds from people who hold them, okay, from the big banks. So when the Fed wants to buy bonds, it will go to J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citibank, shitty bank as I call them, HSBC America, Banco Santander, you know, whoever. Whoever's interested in selling treasury bonds, the Federal Reserve will pay them money, will buy those bonds, and it will pay those banks money. Okay, those banks suddenly have a lot of cash on hand. What are they going to do with that cash? It's just sitting there on the balance sheet. It's not earning anything. So if it's sitting as a deposit on a bank's balance sheet, you have to understand that banks view deposits as liabilities, because they are liabilities. They have to pay interest on that cash to somebody. So it's a liability for the bank. To turn that liability into an asset, the bank then turns around and lends that money to somebody else, usually to a consumer through the form of a home loan, or to a business through the form of a business loan, and so on and so forth. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and I know I've digressed for about 10 minutes on this subject, but it's important to understand. The myth here is that there is something backing all the debt, all the money that's in the economy. There isn't. It's all debt, okay? All of that is debt. What's happening here is that the Federal Reserve has bought something with tangible value, an actual bond, has given money to a bank, and now that bank is going to take that money and issue it in the form of a loan. That is not real. There's nothing backing that money. There's nothing, no contingent claim on the money that the bank has just issued to you in the form of a loan. If you come to the, you know, if Shitty Bank gets $500,000, from the Federal Reserve for selling, you know, some tiny amount of a bond, and it is tiny, I mean, 500 grand for a U.S. government bond is a pittance. It's nothing. It doesn't even register on a bank's balance sheet. It's like a, it's a rounding error, basically. From there, the bank turns around and loans you $500,000. If they're paying less than 1% in deposit, you know, in terms of interest on deposits to the Federal Reserve for that 500 grand, they're now going to turn around and lend you $500,000 for 30 years at 3.5% as a home loan. Guess what? They've just made an enormous amount of money, relatively speaking, because all of that interest for 30 years is going to come back to them in the form of cash. Banking, when it's done right, is a hugely profitable business. As long as you aren't stupid with your risks, you can make a lot of money from banking. Okay? They then turn around and lend you that money. Okay, what's backing it? Absolute dick all. There's nothing backing that money. It's all debt. Okay? Or they will lend that money out to other banks. And again, you know, banks are required to keep a small fraction of that money on their balance sheet as part of fractional reserve banking, but they will then lend that money out to other banks. Again, you follow the trail of the money. It's not backed by anything. There's nothing holding it up. It's all thin air. It's all debt. It's all contingent claims on debt. It's debt compounded with debt, compounded with debt, compounded with debt, ad infinitum. Okay? And now you understand, I hope, the scale of the problem. Because now you're going to realize that the moment that somebody comes knocking for that money, and realizes it's not there, the entire system collapses. That is precisely what happened in the 1920s. Banks lent out too much because the Federal Reserve, through its open market operations, expanded the balance sheets of those banks too much. The Federal Reserve aggressively bought U.S. treasuries from 1924 to 1928. And then, because it thought that the economy was overheating, tried to tighten things up in 1928 and throughout 1929. For 4 years, it created conditions ripe for a collapse. And then in 1929, that collapse happened. Because the Federal Reserve moved to aggressively tighten interest rates because they thought that the economy was overheating and needed to cool off a bit. So interest rates went up significantly. If you look at the history of the Fed funds rate, and you go to the FRED, effective federal funds rate, the St. Louis FRED, Federal Reserve, they don't have data going back that far, to the 1930s, which is, real pity. Let's see, effective Fed rate in 1920s. The Federal Reserve in the 1920s, let's see. So, yeah. Yep, exactly what I thought. Basically, what it was called at the time was the overnight broker lending rates and New York Fed discount rate. The data I'm looking at are 1919 to 1930. I'll try to include this with the links in the podcast. If you look at the data from about 1924 to 1928, the interest rates hold pretty steady. Okay, they hold at around 3.5 to 4%. Okay, they're in that kind of range. And then in 1928, the Fed started tightening. The interest rate rose to about 5% in 1929, and stayed that way throughout most of 1929. The New York Fed discount rate, I'm talking about, and rose sharply at the end towards the sort of third quarter of 1929 to almost 6%, and stayed that way into 1930, and then finally the New York Fed started loosening things up a bit. There is no question that this is what caused, initially at least, the collapse. No doubt whatsoever among economic historians that I've seen. There is no doubt that this was the primary driver of the Depression of the 1930s. That increase in interest rates was catastrophic because it caused businesses to pull back on lending, it caused consumers to stop borrowing, and it caused a major debt deflationary contraction. Now, that's not a bad thing, not necessarily, because when people take on too much debt, eventually that debt either has to get paid back or defaulted upon. Or is defaulted upon. Okay, there are only two ways out of it. Either you pay back your debts or you default upon them. If you are in debt, then it makes sense when interest rates are low to borrow more, but eventually you're going to get into such a big hole that you can't get back out of it anymore. And that's precisely what happened to a lot of consumers and lenders in the 1930s, or I should say in the late 1920s. When the collapse came, it came because the Federal Reserve tightened interest rates. This is power that the Fed never should have had in the first place. And again, I come back to the fact that there is nothing backing up all of this funny money. It is funny money. It's all debt. It's all of it is debt that's out there. So the moment that the debt creation system stops and people stop borrowing, there is no way to perpetuate that system anymore. You cannot, the way to look at a fiat money system is that it is a train building up tremendous speed and momentum, and it's all powered by debt. But the speed and momentum of that train depends entirely upon more and more and more debt being created in its internal, you know, combustion engine. The moment that the fuel of debt runs out, the train doesn't just slow down and come to a halt. It actually, it's like it smashes head, it smashes locomotive first into the side of a mountain. Okay? That's how bad it gets when that situation arises. We've seen this happen 4 or 5 times in the last 100 years. The first one, the first really catastrophic example, was 1929. The next one took place, some years later, in the 1980s, with the crash of 1987, basically. But there were examples before that of major market crashes caused by overly loose Federal Reserve policy when they started tightening again. And actually, before that, even before the crash of 87, in the 1980s, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when under Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, the Fed started tightening rates, which, again, I agree with, that was necessary, the U.S. economy really, really suffered from it. But it was necessary to do it. We're also seeing, in 2000, the results of a debt-driven bubble imploding, and in 2008, another one, and we're seeing it again now, in 2020. It just doesn't look like it because of the coronavirus basically shutting everything down. So, what are we looking at in terms of overall results? Well, again, we have to take a look back at the 1920s, and we have to look at the economic history of the Depression. So, having conclusively established, I hope, that the Federal Reserve was at fault for the 1929 crash and for the subsequent massive spike in unemployment and the drop in production, what did governments do at the time? Well, here's the next myth we have to bust. Herbert Hoover was not a laissez-faire president. He was nothing of the sort. Herbert Hoover campaigned on the idea of big government. Calvin Coolidge called him Wonder Boy, and it was a very disparaging label, because Herbert Hoover's background was in engineering, and he thought that as an engineer you could solve all problems through appropriate application of intellect and effort. Herbert Hoover was the kind of man who thought that you could very easily use government power and government influence and government engineering, effectively, to solve the problems of the common man. Calvin Coolidge thought very differently. He believed in constitutional safeguards and protections for ordinary people, and he believed that the government's role was to stay out of people's way and to stay out of their lives. Well, there's a reason why Calvin Coolidge is considered one of the greatest presidents of all time, and why Herbert Hoover is laughed at. Coolidge was lucky enough to preside over the Roaring Twenties, and Hoover was unlucky enough to preside over the Great Depression. The problem is that Hoover himself created these problems. He created this situation for himself. He was the one who started meddling in the corrections that had to happen in the marketplace. He was the one who went after firms for producing too much and for firing people. He was the one who tried to start up big public works projects. He was the one who tried to meddle in the necessary corrections of the markets, of the banks clearing out their balance sheets, of people unwinding their own personal debts, of people living within their means once again. That was all him. Unfortunately, the reason why he is remembered as a laissez-faire president is partly because of FDR coming along, you know, when he did, partly because of World War II kind of rewiring everyone's memories, and partly because of the socialist takeover of the education system, not just in the United States, but around the world, around the Western world at least. The reality is that nobody in a college-educated environment, at least in, you know, if you go to any university with a decent economics department, not one of those universities still believes the myth that Hoover was responsible for basically letting the market do its thing and believed that the market would always clear. And that's not what he believed at all. There are still plenty of universities that believe that FDR saved the nation, but there are nowadays, fortunately, many more economics departments where the consensus is what the data tells us, that FDR made things much worse. So Hoover was not a laissez-faire president. Hoover made things much worse, and he started making things worse in 1930 itself. If you look at the economic data coming out of the USA, what we have of it tells us that by January of 1930, the crisis had peaked. The collapse had resulted in hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost, maybe millions, definitely millions, in fact. Thousands of businesses closing down, millions of customers losing their savings, and it was basically a hard reset for the system. The government did not step in much during this time because basically Hoover was still trying to find his feet. I mean, he was elected in 1928. He spent much of 1929 trying to kind of consolidate his administration. The crisis, the collapse, took place at the end of October 1929. So it wasn't really until 1930 that he could start reacting. And react, unfortunately, he did. Because while the market, while the U.S. economy was recovering and output had started increasing throughout 1930, unemployment had started dropping throughout much of 1930, and by June 1930, things were looking significantly better. You know, output and production had resumed course, unemployment was back down below 6%, it was actually considerably below 6% at the time. Herbert Hoover started meddling. And that's when things really started going wrong. Now, to get the full details of what he did, you really have to read The Forgotten Man. Or you can read, what's it called? Eugene Smiley. I forget the book that he called, the book that he wrote. There's a book called, I think, Rethinking the Great Depression. And, I think it's by Eugene Smiley. I have to go look it up. Another great book. Where he basically lays out exactly what Hoover did to make things much, much worse. So, the next 2 years of Hoover's presidency were spent with double-digit unemployment and extremely painful contractions in economic output because businesses didn't know what kind of environment they were facing. It was complete uncertainty on almost every front. What was going to happen? Nobody knew. What was going to come out of the, you know, the government next? Nobody knew. There was no certainty, and that's exactly what businesses need. To understand how businesses operate, you have to ask yourself, what is the difference between risk and uncertainty? Okay, businesses exist. Individuals exist to take risks. Risks and uncertainties are two completely different concepts. And here's the best explanation I've ever heard for the difference between the two. Risk is when you know the set of possible events. All that remains is to assign probabilities to those events in the form of a probability distribution of some kind. Those who assign those probabilities correctly are the ones who will profit and prosper. Those who assign probabilities incorrectly will lose and suffer. Uncertainty is when the events themselves are completely unknown. You don't know what's going to happen. When that takes place, there isn't even any point in assigning probabilities because you don't know what's going to take place. You don't know what's coming next. In that regime, there is no point in making future plans because you don't know what's going to happen. So there is no use in planning for anything. Businesses exist, they thrive, they rise, and they fall when it comes to risk. The entire point of business is to take risks. Businesses cannot even operate when there is uncertainty. When government intervenes constantly and consistently, without any sort of overarching philosophy, without any kind of sense or sensibility, the result is uncertainty, and the result of that is chaos. And the result of that is market failure. That is precisely what happened in the 1930s. So we get through Herbert Hoover's unfortunate and misbegotten reign, and we come to FDR. FDR is an interesting character, morally very deeply flawed and fallible, extremely charismatic, extraordinarily charming, tremendous personal courage because he had to overcome the crippling effects of polio, but also a deeply dangerous man. I mean, charming as the devil himself, but with no moral backbone, no ideological consistency, no character defining traits that we can think of other than his extraordinary courage, his personal courage. Definitely morally vacuous. I mean, he cheated on his wife constantly. You know, he would step out, or in his case, you know, roll out on his wife quite a bit. He didn't really have, contrary to popular opinion, he did not really have an overall philosophy of government or governance. He did not really have an overall economic philosophy. A lot of people are taught and misguidedly believe that he was a Keynesian. He wasn't. John Maynard Keynes did not write his general theory of unemployment, interest, and wages until 1936. It was not published until 1936. Whatever advice that FDR was getting did not come from Keynes. It came from some obscure economist somewhere in Minnesota, I think. Or was it Wisconsin? I forget. But it was somebody that nobody had ever heard of, and nobody has heard of since. Ultimately, though, FDR is the reason why the Great Depression lasted as long as it did. It was because of FDR and the chaos that he introduced into the markets that things took as long as they did to recover. The Federal Reserve tried very hard to cut rates throughout the 1930s. So if you look at, let's see, Federal Reserve rates during the 1930s, you know, if you look over time, and let me try to look it up, Federal Reserve rates during 1930s, and interest rates in the Great Depression, here it is. And what happened during that time? Well, it's hard to find the information, but let me see if I can find some pictures showing this. It's hard to do. But basically, the Fed kept rates low for a long time throughout the early 1930s, and then slowly started to tighten them back up, with the result that in 1936 there was a repeat of, you know, another collapse in employment and production. So, you know, by 1938, the U.S. was right back where it started, pretty much, and it was quite simply disastrous. There's really no excuse for what they did, but they really did a terrible job. They basically seriously messed up at every level of government. You know, the Roosevelt administration passed, rammed through Congress something called the National Industrial Recovery Act. This basically gave the government full power over the entire economy to set wages and prices. And misguidedly, the government thought that the reason why the economy was in such a tailspin was because companies were being too cutthroat in their competition, that competitiveness was driving down wages and prices. And misguidedly, the government thought that the correct way to manage an economy was through high wages and high prices. This is frankly idiotic. I mean, it's so stupid. Anybody even back then could have figured out this was dumb. And people did figure out it was dumb. I mean, people were, you know, there were economists screaming about how dumb this was as an idea. They were silenced. Why? Because the academic economists of the time all saw the light. They all saw that basically, if you gave the government a kind of rubber stamp to spend money, which is what governments always want to do, and to gain power, which is what governments always want to do, and to tax people, which is what governments always want to do, guess what? If you give them the imprimatur to do that, you get rewarded by the government. If you basically take the ticket, and it was a ticket, it was exactly the same kind of ticket that people take these days to sell their souls and to sell out their principles for fancy pants and lollipops, to use the phrase of our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him. So all of the things that resulted out of the Great Depression were very clearly the result of government. Now, that is a major myth that we have all been taught, that, you know, government solved the Great Depression. It bloody well didn't. Government did not solve the Great Depression. What solved the Great Depression was indeed World War II, but it didn't solve it in the way that everyone thinks it did. World War II did not solve the Great Depression by putting the economy in a command economy kind of framework. That's not what happened. World War II solved the Great Depression by basically destroying all economic rivals of the United States. And then, when the USA deregulated and freed up its own economy, it was the productive engine of the entire world. And everybody, every major country linked its currency to that of the USA. So the USA acquired almost overnight preeminent status as the world's greatest manufacturer, the world's greatest creditor, and the world's reserve currency. Overnight. I mean, like, at the end of World War II, that was it. That was the state of things. So when you have all of those things going for you, and you start liberalizing your economy, you don't go into a command structure. Because once Roosevelt died and Truman took over as president, a lot of that liberalization had to happen anyway. Because the military had to be demobilized. All of that wartime production had to end anyway. People had to find jobs on their own. It was going to happen one way or another. So once things started to free up, and once the post-World War II sharp economic contraction finished, and recovery started, as you know, factories realigned and started hiring workers, the labor force began to expand rapidly, and so on and so forth. You had the booming 50s. The result of all of that was a world tied to the U.S. economy as its economic engine. The U.S. economy was and still is the economic engine of the entire world. It's the turbine that powers the world. So when that is roaring ahead, full power, the rest of the world roars ahead as well. Now, let's look to what we can anticipate in the future from our current situation. Having dealt with these myths of the past that, you know, the Federal Reserve managed the economy competently in the 1920s, it didn't. That the Federal Reserve is a government institution, it's not. That the government was responsible for bringing the world out of the Great Depression, it didn't. That FDR was some kind of great hero for managing the Great Depression the way he did, he didn't. He did it completely incompetently. There is one more myth we need to look at. It's the idea that tariffs deepened the Great Depression. I actually wrote to Vox Dei like more than 10 years ago now, and asked him about this, because I read somewhere in, I think, Eugene Smiley's book, that the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act deepened the Great Depression. Vox Dei tore this argument apart in his own book, Return of the Great Depression, in 2009, I think it was written. It's a great book. If you haven't read it, highly, highly recommend it. Brilliant book. One of the best books on economics you will ever read. Very accessible. He basically looked at the actual output data and the actual GDP data and the actual import-export data from the 1930s. And he saw very clearly that the drop in output and the drop in overall output could not possibly have been caused by the drop in exports and imports. The change in exports and imports after the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was way too small. It was nowhere near enough. I mean, in terms of percentage points, it was tiny compared to the overall drop in actual output. So there is no way that GDP could possibly have been affected so badly by the results of the Smoot-Hawley Act that it was one of the drivers of the Depression. It wasn't. It absolutely was not. Okay? This is germane to our situation today, because his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, has done what almost no U.S. president in like 50 years since St. Reagan Magnus of the Right had bothered to do, which is to impose blanket tariffs on a country for its anti-competitive, anti-American practices. Donaldus Magnus has done that, and, you know, glory be to Donaldus Magnus for this, because he has understood that trade is a weapon of war. These tariffs are not going to destroy the U.S. economy. They're not going to destroy the Chinese economy. They're not going to destroy the world economy. They're too small. They don't register as even a blip. Okay? $300 billion worth of tariffs is a rounding error compared to a $20 trillion economy. All right? Understand this very, very well. The numbers don't add up. All right? If you take 300 into 20,000, which is effectively what you're talking about, or 3 into 200, which is effectively what we're talking about, we're talking 1.5% of the entire US economy. That's it. That's a fucking rounding error, okay? Excuse my French, but I have to drive home this point. That is a rounding error in terms of the overall economy. It's tiny. There's not even any point in discussing the idea that tariffs are going to derail the world economy. China must be held accountable for what it has done to the world. China and the Chinese people must be taught a lesson that they will remember in their very bones for what they did. And the way to do it, or one of the ways to do it, is through tariffs. That is not over intervention by the government. That is a good thing. That is one of the few things the government actually has legitimate power to do, is to impose tariffs upon competitors and enemies. Trade tariffs and trade wars are a good thing in the end, particularly for the US economy, which has outsourced so much of its manufacturing to a hostile foreign power. This is a huge opportunity for the US if Donaldus Magnus maintains his policies the way he has said he will, and continues to impose tariffs, and continues to punish the Chinese. That's a very good thing, because the Chinese need the US much more than the US needs China right about now. So, looking forward to the coming depression, and it is going to be a depression, we're looking at double-digit unemployment. We're looking at a 7 to 10% contraction in the US economy. We're looking at a $22 trillion economy going to a $20 trillion economy in the space of a few months. That's astonishing. In order to overcome these effects, what is needed? Well, if the lessons of the 1930s are followed, the government cannot, for the love of God, cannot intervene by setting prices and wages, by trying to ensure full employment, by forcing businesses to keep people on their payrolls even when they can't afford to. Once the plague is done, once the panic is lifted, once people realize that it wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be, a lot of the businesses that had to let people go are going to shut down, but other businesses are going to come in to take over those lost assets. It's going to take 6 months to a year for all of that to shake out, without too much government meddling. But if the government insists on telling people to keep their doors open no matter what, that we're going to backstop you no matter what, the consequences for failure are completely removed. And this is deadly, because it just kicks the can further down the road. Those businesses which were unprofitable needed to close. Those businesses which didn't have enough cash on hand needed to close. Those people who didn't have enough savings on hand, well, they're really going to suffer, and I'm truly sorry about them. One of the few legitimate places where the government can help them is through tax cuts, is through direct redistributions of their own tax dollars back to them. That's a good thing, but it's not enough. What people really need right now is certainty, not uncertainty, certainty. Risk has to be in the environment. Risk has to be out there. Risk must be part of the American way, must be part of the global way. The moment the government tries to step in and remove all risk, you get economic stagnation, which is exactly what happened in the 1930s. Massive economic stagnation and massive global depression. If the government moves under Donald Trump, under the God Emperor, to fix prices or fix employment or fix wages, we're doomed. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think as a businessman, the God Emperor understands the need for risk. He understands what it takes to build businesses. And he's not your typical politician, thank God. He is something we've never seen before in American politics. And again, thank God for the God Emperor. I don't know what he's going to do. I have faith in him. I think he's going to do the right thing. But if he decides to pass an aid package through Congress that you know, procures all these stupid goodies and tries to keep people in unprofitable, failing jobs, and tries to keep useless sectors of the economy open, and I'm sorry, you know, I genuinely apologize for people listening to this who think I'm insulting them directly. I am not. I feel great empathy for you. I truly do. If you have lost your job, I am so sorry. I know what you're going through. I've been through it 3 times myself. I know what it's like not to be employed for 9 months at a time. I'm going through it right now, again, for the second time in 2 years. I know what it's like to feel that sense of misery and pain. I understand it. I really do. I'm sorry for what has happened to you. But I can't let my personal feelings get in the way of the facts. And the facts are that for the last 12 years, since 2008, a massive amount of debt has been run up. And that debt has to be unwound. It is going to be unwound no matter what. There is going to be debt deflation no matter what we do, no matter what the government does. And it has to happen. All of that money that was created during, or most of it, that was created during the last 12 years, was funny money. It was not real. And it has to be paid back somehow. The only way to pay it back is through deflation. So, the lesson for the future is don't intervene, don't meddle too much. Give people hope, by all means. The God Emperor is doing a phenomenal job of that, actually. Every time I watch him during one of his live briefings, I'm like, wow, this guy is amazing. He's truly a highly competent and skilled crisis manager. Thank God he's the president right now. But introducing uncertainty and introducing government nationalization schemes will be a disaster. Give people money to get back on their feet. Give people a chance to take risks again, by all means, but don't do what Roosevelt did in the 1930s and try to control the economy, because that will be a true disaster. Well, we're about out of time. We only got a couple minutes left. I hope you enjoyed this somewhat rambling rant about the results of the 1930s, the myths that we have endured over the past 100 years. And I hope that it has provoked some thoughtful ideas in your head about what we're facing. The key right now is not to lose hope. We're going to get out of this. I have no doubt about that. We're going to get through this. We're going to come out of it on the other side. I do believe that by the end of April, we should see a significant turnaround in the way things are going in the USA. I do believe that lockdowns will start to be lifted. And I do believe that America will get back to work, get back to business, because that is what America's about. It's about business. So, thank you as always for listening in. I greatly appreciate your support and your patronage. Well, not patronage, but you know, your following me, if you will. And as always, feel free to leave a comment here, like and subscribe if you have not done so already. Leave a comment at the blog, like and subscribe there, or subscribe there if you haven't done so already. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 23, Myth Busting. I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.